Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Sunday, March 11th, 2007, on the premier radio networks, including XM Satellite Channel 152 and local talk stations all over the country. Check your local station for time. This is episode 334. Hello there, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, talking high tech with you as I do every week at this time at 8888 Ask Leo. Notice I don't say computers, it's high tech. Anything with a chip in it, home theater, you know, big screen TVs. I have Linux running on my Pioneer HD TV. I mean, those TVs are computers, really. Cell phones, probably the best-selling computing device in the world. Nearly 1 billion cell phones sold last year. So more people have cell phones, certainly, than computers. And nowadays, many cell phones are more powerful than the computers of 10 years ago. So we'll talk about cell phones, MP3 players, camcorders, digital cameras, and of course, computers and the internet. This is the place, 8888 Ask Leo. It could be Ask Leo, could be Tell Leo, could be Yell at Leo. 8888 Ask Leo. Forbes says, oh, I should mention before I get to my sermonette for today. You did, obviously, if you're listening now, you did set your clocks properly, yes? It is, you know, 1 hour later than you think. Might be 1 hour later than your computer thinks. Now, daylight savings time came early, 3 weeks early this year, was, you know, in years past, April 1st, or whatever the first Sunday of April was. It would have been April 1st this year. And that's to save energy. The idea being to keep more people in the working in the daylight hours, so they use less energy for light. We'll see if it saves any energy. It certainly confuses many devices. Now, I woke up and it's funny. My cell phone was fine. Most cell phones, or many cell phones, get their time from the network. The network time will have been changed, so the cell phone was fine. My super duper fancy atomic watch, however, was not. And that's not going to be unusual because in fact, it might end up being a problem. I had to set it to a different time zone. And normally it compensates for daylight savings time. But of course, it's just a watch. It didn't get reprogrammed. So in 3 weeks, I'm going to have to set it back to my normal time zone. But if I hadn't done that, I could have just changed the hour, but it's an atomic watch, and atomic clocks will do the same thing. They'll automatically set themselves, right? So the only way to really get it to set itself correctly is to change the time zone, or change, if you have on your atomic clock a setting that says daylight savings time, turn that on. Your Windows or Mac machine should be all right if you've run updates recently. Apple issued an update for Tiger last month. And if you're using older OSs, I think Panther also was updated. And you're probably even, I would bet, well, I don't know about OS 9. If you're using OS 9, you might have to do this by hand. Same thing for Windows. Microsoft shipped an update for XP Service Pack 2 in February. If you have an older system, you may have to go to Microsoft's page and download an update. We talked a little bit about it yesterday. You know, you can do it by hand, but it's tricky. If you have, for instance, automatic synchronization turned on in Windows, you can set the time ahead an hour. But at some point, Windows is going to set it back an hour because it's going to correct itself. So you either have to turn off the automatic synchronization or do as I did with my watch, change the time zone. Move it ahead an hour. Go to the next time zone to the right. If you're on the East Coast, I don't know what you do. You go to the Atlantic Ocean time. What is it? Canary, Azores time. I don't know. Greenland time. I don't know what it is. If you're on the West Coast, you go to Mountain time. Central, you go to Eastern time. So just go ahead one out. Go to the right. you might have issues with your calendar, and this is certainly, some software may be confused, and this is certainly something to be paying attention to. If you have, for instance, appointment times in the next 3 weeks, it'll all be fine after April 1st, but in the next 3 weeks if you have appointment times, or if you have automatic bill pay services or automatic payment services, automatic anything that goes by the time, what's the worst? It'll be an hour late. Now, that could be bad if it's a meeting. I don't think it's bad if it's a payment, but you might want to check your calendars. Or anything that does things automatically. Gartner Group, which is a big research firm and analyst, says you could see incorrect arrival and departure times in the travel industry. Wouldn't it be funny if you got to the plane on time because you set your clock ahead, but the airline didn't? We're so reliant on computers now and automated technologies that sometimes humans don't even look. Gartner says bank transactions may be late. Trading applications may execute purchases and sales at the wrong time. Cell phone billing software could charge peak rates at off-peak hours. All these things you might want to check when your bill comes. You know if you're that time dependent. I mean, it's only an hour. It's not like a day or a week. It's only an hour. It's not like Y2K. Everybody was so scared about that we'd all go back to the 19th century somehow. And that worked out all right. If you have a cell phone that doesn't get its time from the network, for instance, a Windows mobile-based or a Palm-based OS, you might want to look for patches. I know my BlackBerry, they offered a patch. And the patch is simple. It's not really a big software patch. It just changes the time zone settings. This happens all the time. When Indiana started using daylight savings time a couple of years ago, they had to change that. The Commonwealth Games in South America had their own time zone some years back. That confused computers because some computers only have summertime, non-summertime, daylight savings, or standard. They only have two time zones, and there was a third time zone. So Windows, for instance, which only has two time zones, couldn't handle it. Generally speaking, I don't think it's a big deal. I just wanted to mention it. Make sure your clock is set forward an hour. You did that in the middle of the night. The rich get richer. Forbes is out with its yearly billionaires list. Came out Thursday. And of course, the richest person in the world for the 13th straight year, Mr. Microsoft, Bill Gates, now worth $56 billion. It's almost impossible for the rich not to get richer. Number two, Warren Buffett, $52 billion. He can't possibly he'd have to spend something like $80 million a day on the interest alone. So actually, Warren Buffett's doing something interesting. He's giving almost his entire fortune away. He's given more money, more charitable donations than the rest of the guys on the list put together. He's given it all away, basically. Gates says he'll do that, too. He says he'll give away 90% of his fortune before he dies, that would be a lot. That'd be $51 billion. He's already committed a significant portion of that. Number three, the Mexican telecom tycoon, Carlos Slim. I love his name. Slim, actually, there is a tech angle with Slim. He is, I believe, if not majority owner, a big part of owner of CompUSA. And I think it's at his behest that they're closing stores, trying to become profitable again. Other billionaires on the list, the Google boys, worth $16.6 billion each, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. Interesting story about them is they've achieved this ranking faster than any of the other billionaires on there, much faster than Bill Gates. Last year, they were 26. This year, they're 26. But they're moving up fast. Of course, that was all it's all Google stock, which is just huge. It's gone down a little bit in the recent sell-off, but it's still big improvement. I think it's worth four times what it was when they originally offered it. A lot of the billionaires now are international. Germany is still the number two country after the U.S., but coming on strong, Russia. 53 billionaires. 53 billionaires in Russia, and most of them are young. The average age, 46. There were 178 new billionaires, 53 new nations, 83 billionaire women. Most of those, though, I have to say, family fortunes. Only 10 were self-made of the 83 women. AOL's Stephen Case, back on the list. He'd been gone for a while. He's 840th out of the 1,000, a mere 1.1 billion. It's when you start to talk about 56 billion, 32 billion, 1 billion, it just sounds like so little, doesn't it? Poor Steve Case. However does he survive with that mere $1 billion? Michael Dell is number 30 on the list. Dell Computers, 15.8 billion with a B dollars. And that's why there's so many of these tech guys, the drum is beating for them to start being charitable. Historically, Silicon Valley has not given richly of its recent gains. They're young. You know, I think it's not uncommon for younger people to be less likely to be charitable. Bill Gates has changed that considerably with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's given away billions to for inoculation programs in Africa. His focus is on health, African health, children's health. Although he's also given money to schools for computer systems. I think he wants to be the Andrew Carnegie of his era. You know, Carnegie was the robber baron who built libraries all over the country, free public libraries all over the country. And I think Gates wants to do the same with kind of technology in schools. He's endowed many, many schools for computers. And Warren Buffett, who is his good friend, they play bridge together. Not build bridges, although they could with their money. Play bridge, the game. They probably play for a penny a point. You know, they probably they could play for a million a point. It wouldn't, you know, when you have this much money, the interest alone, as I said, millions a day. 88, Ask Leo. Let's talk about that and anything on your mind. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. From the Tech Guy Labs, looking down upon the beautiful Silicon Valley. Actually, we're in the mobile labs today, I should say. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, down in L.A., where it's supposed to get in the 90s today. It's supposed to get very hot today. And all the people who are suffering the chills of winter elsewhere are going, oh, man. Talking to you about tech, 8888. Ask Leo is the number, 8888. Ask Leo. Hope you set your clocks forward. Coming up in just a little bit. The gadget guru, Ron Rosberg. He's going to talk to us about PMA, the Photo Marketing Association show, which just ended in Vegas. That's where all the new digital cameras are shown. It used to be a film camera show, but now it's digital, and it's really fun. And Ron will have a report. He just came back. He just flew back in his plane. He lost a cylinder, and he had a last. For emergency landing in Palm Springs. He just drove 10 hours, but he'll be here. 8888, Ask Leo's a number. Jeff on the line from Van Nuys. Jeff, Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
Leo, I'd like to ask you, I've been looking for a laptop-type computer. I'm computer-phobic.
Okay.
But I'd like a GPS for my car, and I go to the desert a lot.
Okay.
And I'd like to find a Mac. A friend of mine has a Mac, and they're really into that. So I'd like to find a laptop that isn't outrageous, but I could also have the GPS for not only the maps in the cities, but also maybe for the middle of the desert. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, there is. You know, if you want a standalone GPS device, like, say, the Garmin Nuvi, that goes on your dashboard. It's, you know, it's smaller than a laptop. And that actually comes with maps built into it. So you don't really need to hook it up to a laptop. Used to be you'd have to hook up computer up to these devices to load maps in. And you still do if you want to go to Africa or, you know, somewhere that the map, you know, you have the North American maps. If you're going to go outside that area, you need to load new maps. If you want to do it on, but you want to do it on your computer screen, is that the idea?
No. Well, on the laptop, the problem with the Garmin in that, I looked into that, the screen is very small.
So you want to, you want your big laptop screen to have the maps.
Like at least a 13-inch.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So you can do that. In fact, Garmin, which I think Garmin, in my opinion, Garmin and Magellan are the two biggest names, and I really like Garmin's stuff. Garmin is Mac compatible, so you can they have little standalone kind of GPS devices that plug in via USB, and the map software runs on the Mac, and so you will have all the directions on the Mac. So absolutely, you can do that. In general, most of these companies support Windows better than they support Mac, but Garmin about a year ago said we're going to support Mac. We're going to make a commitment. And so all of their stuff, now, having said that, I'm trusting them because I haven't tried it. So, I tend to use those little standalone devices. I just find them more convenient. I think doing it on a computer is perfectly reasonable. In fact, you'll save money because the computer will do a lot of the work, right? So you don't have to, those little standalone devices are computers with maps, with storage,
right?
All of that stuff. Now you're going to make the computer do the work. So you get a less expensive device that plugs into your computer, gives it the coordinates, and the software that's running on the computer does all the work. So yeah, I think that's a Garmin would be the way to go. Macintosh, there's no reason not to get a Macintosh, but as I said,
you advise not to get a Macintosh?
No, there's no reason not to get a Macintosh, but I do want to point out that in general, there are more choices on Windows. If you go to Garmin.com and you go to the laptop section of Garmin, you'll see Garmin.com. They show you how to do it on a phone, how to do it on a PDA, how to do the standalone things, but they'll also show you how to use it on a laptop. And they have little mobile devices that'll work with a laptop.
What kind of laptop, or is there a specific number laptop?
You know, unlike the Windows world, where there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of manufacturers, an infinite number of, numbers, it's very simple in Apple's world because Apple's the only company that makes Macintoshes. So if you go to store.apple.com or go to an Apple store or a CompUSA or somewhere that sells Apple devices, you'll really see that it's very simple in the laptops. There's two lines. There's the iBook and the MacBook. I'm sorry. I'm showing my age. The MacBook and the MacBook Pro now.
Oh, okay.
The MacBook is the lower end, less expensive. You'll save money. The MacBook is a 13-inch screen, wide screen. The MacBook Pros come in 15 and 17 inch models.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that much.
You don't need that much. And I think a MacBook is probably a very good choice for what you want.
So the MacBook is what I'm looking for.
Yep.
And then I have to add the Garmin stuff to make it a GPS.
Yeah.
A GS.
And the Garmin is a little UPS device. It's about, USB device.
Right.
It's about $129. I didn't have my coffee this morning. It's about $129. And it just hooks up, and then you'll run the software on your Mac, and it'll interface with that, and it'll know where you are, and it'll give you directions, do all that stuff, get waypoints. You actually get much more capability. Let me just make sure that they had said they were going to make it for the Mac. Let me make sure that they are making it for the Mac. Well, you'll find that at Garmin.com. I'm pretty sure.
Jeff Holt.
Hi, Jeff.
Okay, I think I'm losing you. Are you there?
Yeah, my call screener just picked up the line. No problem. It's okay. We're still here. Garmin.com, highly recommended. Their stuff is very, very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Enjoy your new computer. And, don't be computer phobic. It's going to be okay.
Yeah, well, I get a rash when I get close to one.
I understand. But I am the first person to say you don't have to get a computer. But if you want to get a computer, I think a Mac is a very good choice for you.
All right. It's the screen that I need that I
You want a big screen?
It.
Yeah. Hey, you just think of it as an expensive, large GPS. You don't have to do anything else with it. Coming up, a report from the big photo show. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 11:33. No, that's my time. 33 after the hour. Let's put it that way. For wherever you might be, I want to give you the time, but I want to give you the hour because I want to make sure you set the clock ahead. But if I give you my hour, then it could be somebody else's hour some other time, and it would be very confusing. So forget I said anything. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy from the Tech Guy Labs. You know, I'm a little disappointed. I'm looking at the Garmin site. Garmin had promised a year ago, over a year ago, to support Macs, and I think they still don't. They said they were going to update all their software to be Mac-specific, and I'm looking here, and I don't see any mention of the Mac. So I'm a little disappointed. It may be the Mac is not the right... There are programs that are supposed to interface and so forth, but maybe if you want a computer GPS and you're not really looking at anything else, maybe it's you better go with a Windows machine. Certainly, the support for GPS on Windows is far better. And you have to understand, it's not that the companies don't like Macs or they don't want to develop for Macs. It's just that they have limited budgets, and they're going to you have 95% of the market. They're going to develop for you. They're not going to develop for another platform until they can afford it. And I guess they feel they can't afford it, or the Mac audience isn't big enough. Hey, the big photo marketing show just wound up in Las Vegas. The gadget guru was there, Ron Rosberg. Hey, Ron, how are you today?
Good morning, Leo. How are you?
I hear you had a little trouble getting back.
Well, yeah, I didn't quite have an emergency landing. What happened was we flew out of Las Vegas, Henderson Airport, and I was with two other people, and I'm in a Piper Saratoga, and about 40 minutes out, we heard a pop.
Oy.
It turned out to be, I looked at one of my monitors, and one of my fifth cylinder decided to crap out on me.
Yikes.
So we just slowed it down, and we were up 8,500 feet, and we were going to land at Bermuda Dunes, and that's what I did. So instead of an hour flight, it took us an hour and 20, hour and 30 minutes, but... and then I had a drive, and the drive was miserable.
I mean, I'm telling you, 10 hours in the desert.
Leo, I think everybody in the world, we got up to about 30 miles from Livermore. It was like a parking lot. Where was everybody going yesterday?
I don't know.
It was horrible. It was both sides of the road. It was just terrible, and I said, no wonder I fly. Anyway, so I'm a little sad right now.
Oh, Ron. Well, everything's going to be all right. They'll fix it.
Yeah, it's, you know.
Then you have to drive back down and get it.
Leo, if you notice, I wasn't on that list of Forbes.
Yeah, not in the billionaire list.
Yeah,
no,
so it's going to cost me $5,000-$10,000. You know,
oh,
so gonna,
Ron, I'm sorry.
You think
sorry.
Bill Gates would help me out?
He might. You know, that's pocket change for him. That's cigarette money.
Right. Right.
He loses more than that down the couch.
Yeah. Anyway, so and let me tell you, my Casio Atomic Watch, Leo.
Yes.
It's perfect.
It did it.
35 minutes and 27 seconds right now.
You know, that's really annoying. I have this fancy German atomic watch.
Yeah,
Jungans.
And actually, my Timex clock did not. But another little weather thing that has a time, it did it. And then, yeah, so some did, some did not.
You know, I think that, you know, most of these set themselves from Colorado, the WWB
right,
signal
right,
in Colorado. And Colorado sends the correct hour.
Right.
And presumably Colorado adjusted for daylight savings. So it's really, I guess it's how smart the watch is. Does it pay attention to the hour at all? And in this case, my watch does not.
Yeah.
It just looks at the minutes and the seconds. And lets you set the hour. So I'm on mountain time right now.
Right.
So
and
how was PMA?
I'll be the time, Leo. I'll be happy.
I will. What? You'll be the time lady.
Right.
At
right.
The time. So
anyway, well, I spent a day and actually 2 days at PMA, the Photo Marketing Association show.
Worst name for a trade show ever. You have no idea what it is, but it's a camera show.
Well, it's really interesting because I've been going for years, as you know, and originally it was almost all film cameras, right?
Right.
And now I don't know if I saw a film camera there or not, to tell you the truth. Of course, I didn't have really any interest in a film camera, but it's got to be 80-90% digital right now.
There's a fun camera there I saw a couple of years ago, Polaroid Brings. There's only five of them in the world. These cameras were originally made by Land himself out of cherry wood. They're huge. They make Polaroids that are maybe 4 feet by 3 feet. They're
was that right?
Giant Polaroids, one-to-one, and they're beautiful, beautiful. But there's only a few in the world. There's one in Paris, one in New York City, and they bring one to Vegas.
Well, I have a Speed Maggie for a Nikon, if anyone's interested. That's Polaroid also, but I don't think you can buy film for it anymore.
Polaroid back, yeah.
Anyway, so we'll get started. I'll talk about several different camcorders, because I've had a lot of... by the way, if anybody needs URLs or whatever, Ron, what's my new email there, Leo?
You can email ron@techguylabs.com.
Ron at techguylabs.com, because some of the stuff, if you don't hear everything I say or pick up later whatever you want, the URLs or whatever I'm talking about, I'd be more than happy to provide
them. And Ron, if you do me a favor and email them to me, we'll also put them in the show notes.
Yes, it'll be a day or so before I get to them.
Take your time. You've got something else to worry about.
Right, right. Anyway, I'll talk about a couple of camcorders. And one of the real neat camcorders that was at the show is JVC's HD High Def Averio. And it's the model GZ-HD7. And it has, Leo, three 1/5-inch progressive scan CCDs. As you know, most of them are running with single chips, okay? So here you've got three. It's got a 60-gig internal hard drive for up to 5 hours of full high-def recording.
Wow.
And as I say, what they're doing here, each 16.9 progressive scan CCD has a gross pixel count of approximately 570,000 pixels. And the ability to record in full 1920 by 1080i resolution is possible due to JVC's pixel shifting. Now, you might say, well, they're cheating. Well, it's actually the pixel shifting that most professional cameras use.
Okay. So it's kind of shooting at 720p, but they're going to upscale it, basically, to 1080.
But it is a full 1920 by 1080i. Okay.
That's neat. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and this thing, by the way, the EVO GZ HD7 shoots with a broadcast high def video camera Fujinon lens. It's the first time in JVC's history that a third party lens has been used in a consumer camcorder. This thing retails, Leo, the manufacturer list is like $1,795.
That's not bad.
Yeah,
wow.
And it's going to be probably like in the $1,400 price range.
Those Fujinon lenses are what everybody uses. Those are professional lenses. They're very good lenses.
And as I say, by the way, too, I'll be getting evals of these, probably in the next month.
I'd like to get a review.
I'll do a more intensive review, but I want the audience to know about it. Sony also, I guess, introduced really one at consumers, but at the CES show or whatever. And that's like $1,495. It also is a high def camera. They were showing that again too.
Records to tape though, yeah.
No, it's also a hard drive machine too, and to memory stick. Okay, and then also Panasonic. There's another new format, Leo, which is called AVC HD, which stands for Advanced Video Codec High Definition. That's what they're trying to. JVC actually shoots in MPEG-2, and this new codec, the Advanced Video Codec High Definition, is new. But the problem what they're saying with it is there's not any real editing software yet. It's
right.
So brand new that if you go out and buy one, you can't edit it. Edit it for a while.
Okay.
But that's the new Panasonic that they showed also. But one of the ones I want to talk about too in the camcorder and more from probably my price range and most of our listeners, Sanyo. And Leo, you showed this on Regis. The day before you did
the Exacti, yeah.
You showed it the last year, but the Exacti, but it's the Exacti HD2. And what they've done is they've improved tremendously their low light deal. In fact, I went into a closet with the door open, just a jar with no light in it, and they were showing me how it worked in there, and it's really remarkable. And this piece here is $699.
Wow.
So if you want a pocket video high def camera, it shoots it onto SD memory. Will take up to 8 gigs, and you could. It's 1 2.5-inch, 7.38 megapixel CCD.
Do you see any still cameras you like that look interesting?
Yeah. Let's see. Of course, Canon has the EOS 1D Mark III now, which is the world's fastest camera. You can shoot 10 frames per second, Leo.
Wow.
Up to 110 JPEGs or 30 RAW. It has a 3-inch LCD with live view mode.
Oh, man.
As you know, most SLRs are not live view. Once the shutter's down on the thing. And also has EOS cleaning. Now, it's not inexpensive, Leo. It's a $39.99 camera. It's $4,000. But if you're looking for almost a pro camera.
How many megapixels is it?
That one, I believe, is 10. 10.1.
That's the 1D.
Yeah. Yes, the EOS 1D. And Nikon has the D40X, which is also a 10.2 megapixel. And it has a 2.5-inch screen.
That's their entry-level SLR.
Yeah, right, right. And of course, the Canon's got a 3-inch LCD.
Yeah.
One of the neat little cameras that I like, Leo, too, is just a pocket camera. Pentax has the T30 now. And what's really kind of nice about this, if you really, you know how you get into a little pocket camera, you've got so many menus to go into, Leo, and stuff to find stuff. This is touch screen. comes a little stylus, and you just touch it. Like, if you want to set the time now because you want it because of the new time, it is so simple. You just find hit time, and then you use your stylus to go up and down just like you do a PDA. And it has a 3-inch LCD display.
Like those big LCD displays.
Yeah, it is.
Makes them? It's what's fun about it is a lot of times when you take digital photos, you're sharing it with people right at the spot, and it's nice to have a big LCD. So not only so you can review them, but so you can. It's like it's for a party. You can say, "Look!"
It becomes your picture viewer.
It's so much fun. Yeah,
$349, of course. And then there were lots and lots of small little digitals, and I'll get into those as I get evals in the coming months and stuff. I'll talk about some accessories which I thought was kind of neat.
You got about 1 minute.
Okay. Leo, I remember I talked about the live view on an SLR.
Okay.
There's a company called ZigView, or actually it's digital. It's SECU line, CQ line, makes a ZigView S2. Leo, and what it is, on your SLR, you just pop this on your viewfinder, and now it has an LCD screen, Leo.
Huh.
So you're able to see live view. A lot of people want to see exactly what they're going to shoot.
The reason you don't see them in SLR is because the mirror is in the way, and
exactly.
It has to drop
so
out of the way.
People kind of like that. Another kind of neat thing was called Camera Bright. We've had this out for a couple of years, but for your digital cameras, just screw it into the tripod socket on the bottom, and they're not very expensive, $29 to $35, and it gives you, they're using LED lights, Leo, to give you more flash.
Yeah,
and
I've used those. Those are quite, they're interesting. They give you.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And last item I'll talk about, is, Leo, it's kind of an accessory, but it makes little photo albums, pocket-sized photo albums. And it's called Zoom Album, and it comes in a thing with three. You can print your own covers. It is really kind of a thing. I'll get the URL up. It's very easy. It's zoomalbum.com.
So you don't send it to them. You do it. You print it on your printer.
Yeah, you print it on your printer. And what it is, it's kind of neat because they have this special paper, and you can do like about 12 photos in each album. And what it does, it puts a little small pictures, and you then build this little album just on one page. It's phenomenal. And it folds in such a unique way, goes into this book with adhesive, and now you have a picture book to put in your pocket.
Very cool. Ron, get out of the closet. You're done for the day. Have
okay,
a great day.
I want to go out and enjoy this weather.
Enjoy the weather. Ron Rosberg is a gadget guru. It's ron@techguylabs.com. More of your calls coming up. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. This portion of The Tech Guy is brought to you by my internet service provider, DSL Extreme. Call 866, the number 2, GetNet, or visit them online at dslextreme.com. From the Tech Guy Lab South in beautiful Sherman Oaks, California, I am Leo Laporte, The Tech Guy. 8888 Ask Leo is the number, 8888 Ask Leo. There are too many conferences going on all at the same time. It's frustrating. You know, the big conference for geeks right now, going on this weekend is South by Southwest in Austin. It's interesting because that was an interactive music festival for a long time. Independent artists, you know, Austin's got a great music scene. And then they started to move more and toward the interactive area, the web. And now it really is the big Web 2.0 meeting. It's where everybody who's involved in cutting edge websites, web design, web applications is. And we'll have a report, I'm sure, on South by Southwest next weekend. From some of my friends who have been there. Also coming up a little later in this show, my good friend Scott Wilkinson, the TV video HD guy, he's going to talk about what HDMI is. Did you know that there's like 4 different versions of this new connector for high-def TV? HDMI, what it means to you, coming up. 8888 Ask Leo's the number. Let's go to Boston. Kevin, welcome. I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Very good, thanks. I wanted to ask you about playing audio through Skype so the other people in the conference can hear it because I do a podcast and we're getting to like the 45th episode and I hear your podcast and they're very well done and I want to kind of up the quality a little bit in that.
It's tricky. And Skype, of course, is a voice over internet product that I'm just a big fan of. It's free. It allows you to call any computer anywhere in the world for free with very good quality, but you can also call regular phones and regular phones can call you, et cetera. But I use it for my podcast. Many podcasters do, as a way of doing interviews that frankly sound, if you do it right, just as good as a real studio interview. I mean, you know, you can't tell. If you listen to some of my podcasts, it sounds like the guy's sitting right next to me. He's not. It's over Skype. So the way I do it, which is a little more expensive, I have a mixer. So I'm recording on one machine. I have Skype on another machine, and I have a mixer. And, of course, then I can feed audio to the guys through the mixer, just as my mic is being fed to them. Most people, and I imagine you're doing this, Kevin, do it in one computer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And is it a Mac or is it Windows?
Yeah, it's a Mac. It's a MacBook.
You know, it's a routing thing, and I suspect that Audio Hijack Pro from Rogue Amoeba will allow you to do it. I haven't tried it, but, you know, what are you using to record right now? You must be using something like that.
Yeah, I'm using Wiretap Pro now.
Wiretap. Same company.
Very similar.
Yeah. So it's kind of the next thing up from that. And it allows you to do routing. So you can say, okay, I want you to take this sound. You could say, take iTunes and route it out to Skype. Because Skype has an input, right? And so the input normally would be your mic. But you can say, not only route my mic to Skype, but I want to route. It's almost like a hardware patch bay, if you've ever seen an audio setup, where, you know, you connect the output of one device to the input of another device. Well, this is done in software. Very good software. About $40 is from Rogue Amoeba. You already have one of their products. It's just a straightforward recording program. There's another thing that might do the same job called SoundFlower. SoundFlower gives you 16 channels of sound. Same idea, not as easy to use, but you might take it. It's free. Has the advantage of being free. So you might play with that, Kevin. Yeah, because I do that all the time. I play audio back down the pipe. And that's what a mixer does in hardware. Is essentially what this program is trying to do in software. It's trying to, patch the output of one device into the input of another. It's actually quite clever. And it's because, frankly, the Max audio system is very sophisticated. They can do that. Carmen San Diego. You're not the Carmen San Diego. Hello, Carmen. Wait a minute. Oh, I pushed the wrong line. Hold on a second. Now let me press, because this is good. I've got to talk. Carmen, are you the Carmen San Diego?
No, I'm second.
You're from San Diego, but you are Carmen.
I am Carmen in San Diego. That's right. I know.
So I won't sing, "Where in the world is Carmen San Diego?"
Thank you.
You're welcome. I won't do that.
Good.
Yes.
You know what my problem is today? I have a Wi-Fi connection that works fine from home, but the problem is I travel a lot, and when I'm in hotel rooms or other locations, on my email, I could receive email okay, but I can't.
Send it.
I can't send it. Yeah.
Right. And this is dependent on your internet service provider, whoever you're using to send email. And it's a way what they want to do is prevent spammers from using their system to send email. So they want to validate that you belong to them. So are you using your internet service provider as your email sender? Is that who you send it through?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the many internet service providers do this. There's a lot of different ways to do it. The simplest way, the one that's most transparent to users is, well, is he on our service? Is he using an IP address that belongs to us? Well, then it couldn't be a spammer, so let him do it. But as soon as you're on the road, you're using the hotel's internet address.
Right.
And it looks at it and says, well, we don't know who he is. Now, some internet service providers get around this by password authentication, so that you could send from any IP address, but you just have to have your password and log in. You might ask your ISP if they offer that. Another way around it is to use a different mail sending service. A good one is Google. Sign up for a Google Mail account, gmail.com. They're free. They're open now. They used to be private and you had to get an invitation. You don't need one anymore. And they have what these are is called SMTP servers, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. And what you need to send mail is different than what you need to receive mail. You need a Simple Mail Transfer Protocol server, an SMTP server to send the mail. So you'll use Google's and you'll do that in your mail application. You'll actually change it. If you look in your mail application, when you set it up, it asks for two different kinds of servers, a POP3 server for incoming mail and an SMTP server for outgoing mail. And that's the problem, is that you're using your internet service provider's SMTP server. They look at you when you're on the road. They say, you don't belong to us. You can't do it. That's called relaying. It's what spammers do. We won't allow relaying. But Google will, because you get into their server with your password. Yeah, and they don't know what address you're at, because, you know, it could be anywhere. So using your Gmail password, so you set up a Gmail account, you don't even have to receive Gmail from them, and you'll change in your email program in Outlook or Outlook Express or Apple Mail, whatever you're using, you'll change the SMTP server to Google's SMTP server, and then your mail will go out. It won't, in fact, from the point of view of your receipt, your the people you receive your mail, they won't notice any difference. It'll be exactly the same as before. I am Leo Laporte. 8888 Ask Leo is my number. I'd love to hear from you. I am the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, saying hello to you and welcome. If you're just joining the show, you think this is the first hour, you forgot to set your clock forward. Or maybe it forgot to set itself forward. We've been talking about that. The mini Y2K bug, the daylight savings time bug, brought to us by the U.S. Congress, although I understand in Canada they did the same thing. And in Tehran, Iran. And Brazil, a few other nations, they moved daylight savings time forward a few weeks. We are now in daylight savings time. Your computer may not know it. And you know what? If it doesn't, for instance, I have an atomic clock that doesn't. It's actually a little tricky. You have to kind of change your time zone. You have to move your time zone one to the right, at least for the next 3 weeks. And you might want to check your calendars and make sure they're not confused. I mentioned coming up, by the way, this hour, we're going to talk about HDMI, which is the new interface for high-def TV. All of the new HD DVD players, many of the older high-end DVD players, your cable box, they'll all support HDMI if they don't already. What is it? What does it bring us? Why did the industry go that way? Scott Wilkinson will join us from the Perfect Vision magazine to talk about it. He's our home theater guy in just about half an hour. If you'd like to join us right now, 8888 Ask Leo is the number, 8888. Ask Leo, the big game developers conference was in San Jose this past week. I said it was conference season. It starts, man, it's just all at the same time. It's frustrating if you're a geek because you want to go to all of these. Sony was there, announced its new PlayStation 3 Home. It's an online 3D world, kind of like Second Life or There. These are very popular 3D worlds. They're not games exactly. You know, World of Warcraft is also a 3D world, but it's a game, right? Where you've got goals and you're doing stuff. It's very social, but There and Second Life are not games. There's no goal. You're just hanging out. It's almost like an elaborate chat. Sony has a number of 3D world games, of course, like EverQuest and its successor, Vanguard Saga of Heroes. Which is really very much like World of Warcraft. I played it, and I thought, gee, boy, this feels like World of Warcraft. Home will not be. If you have a PlayStation 3, you'll be able to join into Home. And, I don't know, chat, hang out, meet people. I've never really understood these. I like World of Warcraft. I'm kind of hooked on World of Warcraft. I can't stop playing World of Warcraft. But there's a game there, and you're trying to achieve stuff. I've never really completely understood Second Life. If it were more realistic, okay. You know, I think that's what we're looking at down the road. I think we're headed in the direction of virtual lives. And I think that's why the press and the media are all excited about this Second Life, because they think it's kind of the beginning of that. But it's so non-real. It's so sensorially deprived. It's like, I don't want to live in a video game world. I want, if you could make it realistic. And if you CNET has some pictures at their news.com site of Sony's home world. And it's very similar. I mean, it's taking advantage of the very powerful graphics engine in the PlayStation 3. So it does look more realistic, but it still looks like a video game. Once you join home, you get a free apartment. And I will put apartment in quotes. You can furnish it. You get a closet, you can hang your clothes there. You can invite people over to your, can you see the finger quotes, apartment. There will also be public areas, and users can create content there, but Sony will have the approval. So you're not going to see any of the problems you've had in Second Life with flying body parts, shall we say. It's been a little bit. Second Life has a very adult component to it. I think that's frankly why it's appealing to a lot of people. Although, again, I'm sorry, but it's not real. And it's really obviously not real. Here's something weird, too. You'll have a movie theater in there. You can watch movies and TV shows through the interface, through the home interface. I think it's appropriate for companies to be working on this, and I understand the appeal to them. And I guess I understand also why some consumers like this stuff, but I don't think it's there yet. It's not something real compelling. I like my First Life pretty well still. And until the Second Life is as real as the First Life, I'm not sure I'm really going to flip out over it. But someday, you know, in not too far distant future, these things will be as realistic as the real world. And then, I don't know, I think we're going to have a problem in society, don't you? Where people just become hooked on this. Already you see people spending 4, 5, 6, in some cases 8 hours a day, their entire free time. They go to work, they sleep, and they play Second Life or World of Warcraft or EverQuest or one of these games, and they live there. That's their life. All their friends are little plastic people in these games. Oh yeah, my best buddy. He's a 16-level Undine priest, and then I have a gnome and a dwarf friend. Now, I make fun of it, but I have to say, I've had problems. I've had a little bit of a problem with World of Warcraft. Had it on my work machine, had to delete it, because I wasn't getting much work done. You know, the game part of these can be quite compelling. And as they get more realistic, I really fear for our society. I think there'll be some percentage of people, maybe quite a large percentage of people, who just don't come out of their house. They just live online. And if you read science fiction or you go to movies like The Matrix, you know that's the vision at least science fiction authors imagine for us. That's what they see the future like. I've talked to some great scientists who say we're very close to this kind of reality. Mentioned it yesterday. In many areas already, you can get fiber to the home. Many areas of the world, you're getting networking speeds of 200 megabits and more. Many scientists believe in the next 10 years, gigabit networking to the home of the internet will be available. Now, at that kind of bandwidth, there's nothing to stop you from doing very realistic worlds, because you have enough bandwidth to send this data back and forth. That's what's stopping us right now. Very realistic worlds. Computers, of course, will have to get more powerful. That's obviously happening. Remember the computer you had 10 years ago? Compared to the computer you buy today? Then multiply it by, get ready, 100 for the computer you'll buy 10 years from now. That's how much of a change I expect you'll see, around 100 times more powerful in 10 years. So that's a computer that's more than powerful enough to create a realistic virtual world. And we're going to see displays that are double the resolution of the current high-def displays. Now, you think high-def looks good, double that. Go from what they call a 2K display, that's the current high-def displays, to 4K displays. And now all the pieces of the puzzle are there. You've got displays that are virtually indistinguishable from reality. If you set that screen up at the end of the hall and you look down the hall, you'd think there was somebody down there, and it wouldn't be. It would be a picture. And if you have enough bandwidth to send that picture, you have enough hardware to play that picture back, I think you're going to have these worlds now that are so kind of limited and not very satisfying, I think can be very satisfying, very real. And then I worry, because I know that I'll have a problem with it. And I think many of us will. I'll want to spend all my time there. If I suddenly disappear in about 5 years, you say, well, what ever happened to Leo Laporte? Whatever happened to him? If you notice, I've put tin foil on all my windows. You'll know. You'll know exactly what happened to Leo Laporte. I worry. I think many of us will be spending all our time in there. Let's say hi to Ben online, too, from Burbank, California. Hello, Ben. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hi. I had a question about, or a couple questions about, I want to set up telephone lines where I can receive incoming calls.
Yes.
That's all I'm going to be doing.
Okay.
And I thought the most economical way would be voice over IP.
Yep.
And so maybe there's a better way. I'm not really sure.
Skype will do that. They have a thing called Skype In, and it is very economical. Pennies a minute, maybe penny a minute, and probably for North America, $15 a year. And incoming calls from any number. Now, the number that you'll get won't be an 800 number. Do you want an 800 number?
No.
Okay, just any local number.
Yes.
Yeah. Skype is probably the most economical way to do that. Now, that requires good bandwidth on your end. Are you going to be talking to people on these incoming calls? Yes, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that requires good upstream bandwidth on your end. I would say if your internet service provider is giving you 384,000 bits a second or better, you're going to be good.
Yeah, I'm good on that. But this is going to be, the lines are going to be forwarded to a cellular phone or a landline.
Okay, so you don't want it coming in on a computer. You want a real line.
Yeah, a real line.
All right.
And
there are a number of services that do this. You could do it yourself much more economically with a program called Asterisk, which you'd set up on a computer, and that computer would have a special board in it that would interface it to the phone system, and then you'd be able to, it really is remarkable. It's a Linux distribution. If you don't want to, if you're not a geek and you don't want to do Asterisk, and you pretty much want to be a geek to do that, but it allows you to set up a very sophisticated PBS system for free, basically, for the cost of a phone line. If you don't want to do Asterisk, then I would suggest a provider that basically is using Asterisk or something similar to give you the same capabilities. It's a little more expensive. I do something like this. I use GotVmail, GotVmail.com, GotVmail.com. I get an 800 number. It's a follow-me service. It's very elaborate mailboxes. I can have a variety of voicemail. I get my voicemail and email as well as online, on the web, or on the phone. Basically, they're using these kinds of sophisticated digital PBX systems to give you very good capability. GotVmail.com. And if you want to know more about Asterisk, it's asterisk.com. And they have a very kind of simple home version. It used to be called Asterisk at Home. They've changed the name. I'll find the new name. But it's really, really remarkable. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More of your calls coming up right after this. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy at 8888 Ask Leo. So just to finish up on that last call, it's really neat what you can do nowadays with telephony, because computers connected with the phone system give you such capabilities, and the internet, of course, adds power too. So for our last caller, we talked to him off the air. What he wanted was a way to take calls from anywhere in the country and cheaply and have them forwarded to a cell phone, and Skype will do that. If that's what you want, you don't want all the fancy voicemail. Well, actually, Skype also does voicemail, but I mean, multiple mailboxes and more elaborate telephony features, you know, PBX style features. Skype will absolutely do that. You can have it forward to any phone. In fact, a lot of people I know, I'll call them on Skype. Skype is the computer based internet phone calling service, but I'll call them on Skype thinking I'm going to get their computer, and it rings and their cell phone answers. Works very well. In fact, if you only used it for that, it'd be great. And I think it's $30 a year. That's called Skype In. And then I think you pay a little bit extra for the capability of forwarding it then to a cell phone. It also has voicemail on Skype. If you want a much more elaborate system with multiple mailboxes, follow me service, voicemail via email, things like that, you might want to look at a more sophisticated service. I use, as I said, GotVmail. I've been very happy with it. That's my 800 number. And it makes, I'm an individual, it makes me seem like a big business. You know, press 1 for more information about the show. Press 2 to talk to, you know, my assistant Dane. Press 3, you know, and it goes on and on and on. Or if you want to track me down, it'll call me on 4 or 5 different numbers. I mean, it's really very sophisticated. And then the real geeks among us use Asterisk, which is really allows you to do almost anything you can do on a professional big business PBX on a simple beige box, an old computer lying around. You have to buy some special hardware to interface to the phone system, It plugs into your phone. But it allows you to do your basically be your own voice over internet service. And the former Asterisk at Home software I was trying to remember is now called TrixBox, TrixBox.org. And that makes it very simple. It's just a single CD that, you know, it couldn't be easier to install. The hardcore geeks who want sophisticated telephony are going to Asterisk. It's open source, free, really very cool. Just to finish up on that. Let's say hi to Connor right now, Atlanta, Georgia. Connor, hello, welcome. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. Okay. Look, I was looking around at microphones. I had a Logitech one for podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of the standard audio jack microphones. I wasn't satisfied.
No, I do not. I don't recommend those because you get it just seems like you get more interference and noise in them. I like the USB mics.
Yeah, what's a good mic for basic podcasting stuff? Maybe some school projects for like around $50 or maybe $75.
The cheap ones that I use and I actually send out when we do Skype interviews for the podcast, and they're very good, is the Plantronics DSP-400. It's about $40. And it gives you good results. Now, if you really want to get better and really get good, almost professional quality sound, Rode, R-O-D-E, at rodemic.com, makes excellent USB, an excellent USB mic. Now, it's not cheap. I think it's $150. But, you know, you might have seen the Snowball, and there are other USB mics out there. And there's, of course, you can use any mic if you have a USB interface. That's a great way to go, but it can be very expensive. I tell most of the people like Merlin Mann who are looking for a good mic for their podcast, I think Rode is the best.
Okay, and also, is there any backup program for the Mac that... basically, we'll back up all my applications and files, but not the system, because I kind of mess up my system and want to do a clean install. and see, when I move to a bigger hard drive, I just use SuperDuper.
Well, that's what I was going to suggest. SuperDuper is really excellent. What do you want to do that the SuperDuper doesn't do?
Can SuperDuper just back up applications and, you know, personal files?
Yeah, you can tell it any folder that you want. You're using SuperDuper to make images, I gather.
Yeah, I made a complete hard drive.
Right. So it will do that, and it's really great. It makes a drive image that allows you to basically take the whole drive and reproduce it. But you can also say, back up this folder. It does synchronization. So you could say, I want you to make sure that this folder is synchronized onto this external hard drive or your .Mac account or somewhere else automatically without thinking about it, and they'll always be equal. It does all of that stuff. So if you've already got SuperDuper, I think you've got the tool that I would recommend. It's easily the best Mac backup out there.
Okay, and also with Boot Camp, when I moved up to my bigger hard drive, I still had my Windows installation, and which I have some important stuff. I mean, I do a lot of robotics stuff, so
oh, cool.
I have my program on there.
Oh, that's neat.
How can I move how I image the whole Windows installation from my older drive and
You're saying it's Boot Camp. It's not Parallels. So it's on the hard drive as a partition.
Correct.
Does SuperDuper not see it?
I tried once with SuperDuper.
And it doesn't see it. Okay.
It cannot restore it. They can image it, but cannot restore it.
Oh, interesting. That's good to know. I did not know that. All right. So you probably then will want to do it from within Windows using a program called Drive Snapshot. It's at drivesnapshot.de. That's my favorite Windows imaging program. It's very good. Are you in the first program, the robotics program for high schools?
Yes.
Your team? What's your team?
I go around with Vex Kids.
What's your team?
We didn't actually do a team this year.
That's cool.
My school just started doing robotics.
First is great. People should look into that if you're in a high school. That's such a cool program. Thanks for the call, Connor. Coming up, HDMI, what does it mean to you? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy here, joining you on our first day of daylight savings time. You didn't forget, did you? Did you forget? Okay. Did your computer forget? 888 Ask Leo is the phone number. 888 Ask Leo. But before we go back to the calls, and I've got some good ones coming up, including Bluetooth problems, indestructible partitions, and Vista issues. But before we talk about those things, I think it's time to talk about HDTV and home theater with our good friend Scott Wilkinson. He's video editor for a fantastic magazine, the Perfect Vision magazine. You'll probably see it on newsstands everywhere, but we've mentioned before, you can get it absolutely free from the website. You download a PDF every month. I think this is very visionary of them. avguide.com. And they talk about home theater, everything, you know, speakers, sound systems, of course, screens, any kind of technology. This is a great place to go if you want that information. And I thought today we would talk to Scott about really probably something that is one of the most important parts of home theater these days, and that's the HDMI interface. Hi, Scott. So for start off, let's see, but what is HDMI?
HDMI, the acronym stands for High Definition Multimedia Interface, and what it is really is a means of getting digital video from a source, such as an HD DVD or Blu-ray player, to your TV, all in the digital domain. It came out of DVI, Digital Video Interface, which was first implemented in computers to connect laptops and so on to monitors, keeping the video information in the digital domain. And that got adopted into some consumer products and then became HDMI. The difference between them is the DVI only carries video information, whereas HDMI carries video and digital audio information.
Well, it's very convenient for consumers, and it's an easy plug. You just snap it right in, and everything's there.
Yep. I do have one little problem with the connector, which is that it's pretty small, and if you have one of these high-end cable connectors with a big, heavy thing on the end,
it
has a tendency to fall out. Whereas
it falls right out.
Falls right out, which is, and especially if the connector on a plasma or an LCD flat panel is facing downward, and you have to plug the cable into it upwards, there may not be enough friction to hold the damn thing in place.
It's kind of loose.
It is kind of loose, and that's the one thing I don't like about it, but there's nothing we can do about it. It is what it is, so we just have to make do with what we can. DVI had these nice little thumb screws that really socks it in place, which I really like.
Now, DVI is kind of the same as HDMI. It's just you can buy an adapter, right?
Yes, that's correct. They carry the same information. There are minor, somewhat technical differences between them. DVI carries RGB, red, green, blue, signals only, whereas HDMI can carry component signals. So that is one minor difference. But yes, you can buy an adapter, you can buy a cable that has a DVI connector at one end and an HDMI connector at the other end, and it generally works just fine.
Is HDMI as good as, better than component?
Well, that's a good question. I've heard a lot of stories about HDMI connections giving people problems. I myself have rarely, if ever, experienced problems with HDMI connection, but I've heard custom installers and other geeks like us talk about the problems they have with HDMI and end up going back to component analog and saying it's just less of a hassle, it's not so much of a problem, and they end up going back to that. I myself have never experienced that, so I don't have a lot to say from my own experience about that.
There may be down the road a requirement to use HDMI. The content protection requires it.
That's correct. That's correct. There is in Blu-ray and HD DVD a little thing called the Image Constraint Token (ICT), which none of the studios have thrown yet, but they could. And if they did, the signal coming out of component would be down-resed, would be down-converted to standard definition.
Now, I'm predicting they won't at this, because if they haven't yet,
no.
Imagine the crisis that's going to happen if all of a sudden you've got a Blu-ray player, you've got an HD DVD player, but you don't have a compliant TV, and it won't play.
That's right. That's right. Or it'll play in a slower resolution, and you won't see the beauty.
Yeah, 480p,
yeah.
Or, yeah,
or
it's terrible.
I or P, either way. The resolution is lower than what's on the disc and what you really want to see with that brand new expensive HD TV you just bought.
So I just, I mean, I imagine the furor that would erupt if they decided to do that.
And yes, I just can't. I tend to agree.
Yeah, but that's always that is the risk, I guess, of not having an instrument.
Yeah.
The other issue that comes up, and I guess it's less of an issue as time goes by, but many TVs don't have enough HDMI connectors.
Yes, that's true. Generally speaking, you've got one or two. And if you have that problem is mitigated somewhat by having an AV receiver or a controller of some sort with several HDMI inputs that you can switch between at the receiver, at the place where all the signals get switched around. So it's becoming less of a problem. One very high-end projector I saw at CES, the guy told me, oh, yes, we've got six HDMI inputs.
That's a little much.
I said, that's enough.
Yeah, that should do. Well, I noticed that the Vizio, which is the low-end warehouse store TV, has four.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess manufacturers are getting wise to this issue.
They are getting wise, yeah.
And the other thing makes sense at the low end. Low-end users are probably not going to have an AV receiver with multiple
with a bunch of HDMI inputs. That's correct. Sure, exactly. The other thing that people are starting to think about and talk about with regard to HDMI is what version of HDMI is implemented in a given product.
There's versions?
I'm afraid so.
Oh, man.
I'm afraid so.
I didn't know that.
HDMI was first released, 1.0 was released in December 2002. Since then, there's been a 1.1, a 1.2, a 1.2A, and a 1.3, which is the big hot topic these days.
Are they compatible?
They are completely compatible and backwards compatible. And so there's really not too much of a problem. A lot of people I've talked to have said, oh, I'm waiting until HDMI 1.3 is implemented. I don't think it's that big a deal myself, and I'll tell you why. 1.3 implements a number of improvements, among them higher bandwidth, which allows faster frame rates. It has a feature called deep color, which represents colors with 48 bits rather than 24. And it has an increased color space, that is the range of colors that can be transmitted.
Hmm.
The problem is that in order for these features, these new features, to be important or to be useful, the content has to be created with them, and both ends of the signal chain need to implement HDMI 1.3.
So you need a new disc, a new player, and a new TV.
Correct.
And that ain't going to happen.
That ain't going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah.
It really ain't. So I'm not convinced that waiting for an HDMI 1.3, that's going to happen soon enough anyway. Most products, by this time next year, most products will have HDMI 1.3. But if you're waiting for 1.3, I don't think it's necessarily a wise thing to do, because even if the products have it, the content isn't being created with it.
Right.
So with this expanded color space or this deep color,
yeah,
it's not. It's going to be of no benefit. It does essentially future-proof the product.
When
you're
shopping,
for way down the line,
should you be looking at what HDMI version you're getting?
Well, you know, always more information is better than less, in my opinion.
Okay, one more question before we go. I've seen HDMI cables for $19, and I've seen HDMI cables for $190.
Oh, sure, and much more than that, even.
Is there a difference?
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time looking at a bunch of different HDMI cables. I think if you get an HDMI cable from a reputable manufacturer,
it's digital. I can't imagine that would make too much of a difference.
No,
cable, maybe.
Yes, that's correct.
You're sending now, bits. As long as the bits get there.
Yep, exactly right. Now, I've seen demos from a company called Visionware that makes an active HDMI cable with actually repeaters in the ends, and they've shown demonstrations of how much lower the jitter is. The
right.
jitter being, you know, the slop range in which the bits get sent and
right.
so on. And I personally haven't seen a lot of difference between HDMI cables in terms of the picture quality of normal content that's
right.
being seen. I just got one of these Visionware cables in, though, and I'm about to start working with it, so I'll give you a report.
Oh, give us an update. All right.
Scott
joins us every week to talk about AV, video, TVs, home theater, all of that stuff. He's video editor at the Perfect Vision magazine. You can get your copy of Perfect Vision magazine free. It's a free download. It's a PDF from avguide.com. I like it because they have links to the website, to videos, and a lot more, so it's really a great way to read the magazine. That's avguide.com. And we'll talk to you next week, Scott.
I look forward to it. Thanks.
Scott always recommends the best stuff. But I have to say one thing. I have yet to see a $150 HDMI cable work better than a $19 HDMI cable. I think when it comes to digital, cheap is just as good. I may not be able to get Scott to say that, but I'm pretty convinced that that's the case. I'd love to hear from you if you think otherwise. 8888 Ask Leo. That debate rages. You know, when you're talking about analog cables, speaker cables, you know, composite cables, S-video, okay. Okay, then shielding the gauge of the wire and all that, that'd make a big difference. But I think when it comes to digital, the packets either get through or they don't get through. But he says you might see some jitter on a lower quality cable. Unless it's a 20-foot cable, I don't think so. But he's the expert. He's the expert. Scott joins us every week. He'll be back next week to talk more about HD. I know you love that subject. I do too. It's fascinating and complex and room for endless speculation. We've been talking in the chat room, by the way, irc.dslextreme.com, about connections for TV and what to use. And I'll do in order of worst to first, worst to best, the RF connector is the worst. Then the composite connector, that's the yellow RCA jack, not so hot. You get more content, more data comes across the S-video connector. So S-video is the next best step up, but it's still analog, and it doesn't give you all the information. The next best up from S-video, and the one you should use if you don't have a digital connector, is component. Don't confuse component with composite. Component is the one that has the three jacks for video. It actually has five if you include audio. Red and white for left and right channel audio. And then there's, what is it, green, blue, and red, green, purple, and red, something like that, for the component jacks. And then a step up from that, if you have a digital TV, is to go all digital, and that could be either DVI or HDMI, which you're just talking about. They're electrically the same. The only difference is DVI doesn't carry audio, so you still need an audio connector. Complicated, I know. More of your calls coming up. 8888 Ask Leo. Thanks for being here. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. From the Tech Guy Lab South in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Sherman Oaks, to be exact. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Yeah, we can take the lab on the road. I just pack it up in 18 giant-sized crates, and we ship them anywhere in the world. The labs are portable. Danielle in Rome, Georgia. Welcome, Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Hi, Danielle.
Yes, how are you doing, Leo?
I'm very well.
Great. I got a question about, I have a Dell 510 desktop, and it's got an 80 gigabyte hard drive, and I'm just wanting to replace the main drive. I don't want to have two. And since it has the Dell partition or whatever, I have no disk to, you know, put on the new drive. So I was just wondering, how do I copy the information that's on there now to the new drive?
When you got the Dell, you didn't get the system restore disks?
No, I didn't get any disks like that.
So then they gave you instructions how to make them, though?
They may have.
Yeah, look through your manual. There'll be an instruction on how to make them. That hidden partition contains the Windows install files.
Uh-huh.
And so unless I'm much mistaken, everyone I've seen that doesn't come with the disks gives you instructions on how to make the disks by hand. You have to have a CD burner, and you have to burn the CDs. And it'll be a number of CDs. It won't just be one or two.
Right.
But then once you've done that, you've created a backup set that you should be able to then put in a new hard drive and restore it. It wouldn't be a bad idea. I know this is a pain and no one wants to do it, but it wouldn't be a bad idea to call Dell and just make sure that you're following their recommended procedure.
Okay.
Because that hidden partition is important. It's what Dell uses to verify that you are, in fact, installing on a Dell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have a Windows install disk you want to use, let's say you if you bought it recently, you got the Vista coupon and you're going to get the Vista install disk, then you don't have to worry about this at all.
Right.
Or I don't think you do. If you have a, let's put it this way: if you have a genuine Windows install disk, not a Dell one that's going to check for that partition, you don't have to worry about it. Do you have one lying around? Are you going to go to XP?
Or Yeah, I'm just on XP. It's about a year old.
You're not going to Vista?
No, not right now.
Well, you must have an XP install disk.
Yeah, I've got one.
Yeah, well, you can always use that.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. If you've not used it on another machine, now, if you've activated it on another machine, then that could cause problems.
Right.
Because Microsoft doesn't like that. But yeah, the key is that this hidden, and I wish they didn't do this, but Dell does it, Compaq, HP do it. A number of other companies do this. I think Gateway, Tiger, I believe. They'll have a hidden partition on the drive. It doesn't even show up in the disk manager or partition. Magic sometimes won't see it. Usually a third-party program will see it, but it's a small partition. It sometimes, if it's very small, it just contains information saying, yes, this is a Dell computer. This is the service ID. If it's a larger partition, and it may contain all of the Windows install files. And that's in a way a great convenience, because when you upgrade Windows, it doesn't have to ask for a disk, but it can be a problem if you lose your hard drive. All that stuff's on there, and you need it, frankly, to go forward. Ed, San Diego, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Ed.
Hi. I've got a problem with my Bluetooth. I've got a G4 PowerBook with fully up to the minute 10.4.8
OS.
The Bluetooth periodically goes out. It's been out for the last month now. While I was waiting for you, it restored itself.
Of course it did, because I'm magic. As soon as you get on the phone, it just knows. It says, oh, Leo's coming, better fix. So
and
what do you connect?
I was able to discover my devices, and I'm trying to find out how to guard against this happening in the future.
Well, it shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I agree.
What are you connecting to?
A mouse and a keyboard.
Interesting. I would say, now, unfortunately, it's an older Mac. I don't know if you're still under warranty, but I would say this is something wrong with it, because especially a mouse and a keyboard, you shouldn't have any dropout. I use on a Mac Mini, I use a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and it never, when the battery dies, I lose it. I have to replace the battery in the keyboard, but it shouldn't just drop out and stop working. It doesn't sound like it's a software issue. It sounds like it may be a loose connection, or, there's an antenna that Bluetooth chip is connected to. Maybe that's a little loose. Maybe it's not connected at all. How old is the Mac?
3.
Has it always done this?
No, it's only done it recently.
It's a desk. It's a desk.
Probably the last 6 months, 8 months.
It's a desk.
Like that.
It's a desktop.
Pardon me?
It's a notebook or a desktop.
It's a PowerBook.
I'm pretty sure on those G4 PowerBooks, even of that era, you can remove the keyboard, right, to look at the airport card and the Bluetooth. I would look at it and make sure that antenna is well connected. It should not be dropping out. It doesn't drop out on a normal system.
Okay.
So it's something I would say, not a software issue, but it's something wrong with the Bluetooth, and it sounds like,
so
frankly, the
I
antenna.
Take it to the Genius Bar or something?
Yeah, the Genius will fix it. I mean, it's not under warranty. You'll be paying for it. But I think it's something that they could easily look at and say, oh, yeah, the antenna is loose. I'm almost betting you that's what it is.
Can I ask you a quick question about iTunes?
Certainly.
Every time they want to update, it's 25 or 40 megabytes or something. Is there any advantage to taking that, and does it just keep growing into this gigantic?
No, it replaces the old one.
Oh, I see.
Don't worry.
So I don't have to worry about it.
No, it's not taking up more space on your hard drive. You do have to download a whole new version of iTunes. In most cases, the iTunes updates are not for your benefit. They're to fix a hole in the copy protection.
Mm-hmm.
We know from Steve Jobs' open letter to the music industry, he finally admitted it. Part of their deal with the music industry is if the copy protection on this music gets cracked, you have several weeks to fix it, Apple, and you better fix it or we're going to pull our records from your store. So what Apple does, and these things get cracked regularly, what Apple does is they send out a patch, and the patch is often not any bug fix or any benefit to you. It's just security changes the way the copy protection works so that you can't crack the songs. Now, in this most recent one, the 7.1 update, is mostly for Apple TV, which should be coming out any day now.
Mm-hmm.
That's that new box that really is kind of like an iPod, but it's designed for shipping video across your wireless network. If you don't have an Apple TV, I don't think there's any real... Oh, it does a full screen cover flow. I don't know anybody who uses cover flow anyway. So, I mean, it's pretty, but it's not a good way to browse your library. So you don't need to upgrade it. In this case, though, it's not a problem, Ed. It's just a download. It's going to replace the existing files. It won't take up more space on your hard drive.
Can I ask you one more quick one?
Quickly.
Okay. When I dark my screen, to step away from the computer, immediately the Apple feed, RSS feed comes on.
Yeah, that's just your screensaver. Change your screensaver. I am Leo Laporte. More to come on The Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy here. Time to talk high tech at 8888 Ask Leo. Anything with a chip in it, that's what we'll talk about. Home theaters, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players. I want to hear from you, your experience. It doesn't have to be Ask Leo. It could be Tell Leo. It could be Yell Leo. It could be You're Full of It. Actually, I have a correction from last show. We ran right out of time right at the very end of the last show. And somebody asked me for a recommendation for a gigabit router, and I said I couldn't recommend a good one. But I don't know what I was thinking. I'm using one in the labs. It's a D-Link gaming gear router. I think it's the 108. It's very good. Gigabit. But I guess my point was, and I ran out of time before I could really explain it, he already had a gigabit switch. He had a gigabit network. The router was going to be used to connect to the internet. Well, the internet isn't that fast. You don't need a gigabit router. So you can buy a cheap router, plug that into the gigabit switch. All your internal networking will still be gigabit. You don't need a gigabit router. Now, if you're not going to buy a gigabit switch, if you just want to use the router as a switch hub and router, then in that case, you would probably want to get a gigabit router. And I like the D-Links very much. I've been very happy. Actually, it's got great software, great firmware. Lots of good security, lots of good settings. I like stuff with lots of settings. That's because I'm a geek. Of course. Lawrence driving on the road somewhere in Florida. Hello, Lawrence. Are you there, Lawrence? How are you, Lawrence? Maybe he drove off the road. I don't hear a thing. I'll put you back on hold, Lawrence, and move on to it. But if we can get back to you, we will. Move on to Matt in Los Angeles. Are you there, Matt? You know what? I think I'm doing something wrong. I'm going to push the buttons back, talk for a little bit more, and then maybe Antonia can explain. I'm trying to pick up a call, and I don't hear anything, Antonia. Let me try Lawrence again on line one. Are you there, Lawrence?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, it wasn't my fault after all.
How are you doing?
Hide your head in shame. Not your fault either, Lawrence, by the way.
That's all right.
I'm doing well. How are you?
It's been a while since we last talked, man.
What did we talk about?
I do a podcast. You came on. You actually were on my show one time.
Oh.
I mean, you were real hospitable. Came over and talked gaming with us for a while.
What's the podcast?
It was XBL Radio.
Oh, yeah. I love XBL.
Yeah. I mean, it was a blast, and I really appreciate it. I didn't want to come on and plug my show, but I'm driving back from Florida listening to XM and heard your show, and very interesting.
XBL is mostly about gaming, yes?
Yeah, it's Xbox Live Radio. I mean, we just sit there and basically talk about gaming 24/7 and tech stuff. But we're big fans of yours.
Since I joined you, I finally got an Xbox 360.
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah,
now, what have you been playing?
My gamer tag is Twit Laporte.
It's Twit what?
Twit Laporte.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so come on, be my buddy because I'm lonely.
Absolutely. Well, I know you were interested in Spore coming out. You were talking about.
I can't wait
till
Spore comes out. When Spore comes out, I am going to be. That's it. It's going to be the end of me. You'll never hear from me again. That's when the tinfoil goes on the windows.
So that's going to be bigger than World of Warcraft for you, huh?
Yeah. I'm a little bit. I have to say, I'm a little bit of a World of Warcraft head. On Xbox 360 lately, I've been playing, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, Dead Rising.
Oh, so you like killing zombies with showerheads, huh?
You heard about that, did you?
Yeah, and then taking photos of it,
yeah,
share with all your friends.
Yeah, you know, it's a vicious, violent, evil game, and yet it's very well designed. And you know what's interesting about gaming? It isn't about the graphics. It isn't about what you're actually doing. There is something about good game design, and I wish I could quantify it. I don't think anybody has, or all games would be a lot better than they are. But that's a well-designed game, and you know when you play it, this is compelling. This is fun.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not about the zombies.
it's got the storyline of a zombie movie like 28 Days Later mixed right. with the fun of everything's interactive pretty
yeah.
much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's part of the fun of it, isn't it? Yeah. But oh, you didn't call me about that. What did you call me about?
Well, let me ask you a question. I just upgraded to Vista because I'm a big fan of, you know, getting new technology. I don't know why I did. I just wanted it because it was new.
Because it's new.
I do a lot of podcasts. I update my iPod almost every other day. I'm taking it to work, listening to it, and updating it.
Great.
I read somewhere that if you just pull it out or don't use the taskbar to, you know, disconnect your iPod from your interface on Windows Vista, that you could actually create your iPod operating system.
That's always been true. And it's not very likely. You know, on the Mac, you have to eject it before you disconnect it.
Okay.
The reason is...
What happens if you just yank it out?
Well, on the Mac and Vista, both use something called journaled filing systems.
Right.
And truthfully, on the Mac, they make you eject. Windows, Microsoft knows that consumers hate that. And so right. they decided not to do that. You remember in the older versions of Windows, you did have to turn, you know, disconnect a unit, you'd have to go down in the system taskbar and right-click on it and
safely
say...
Safely remove hardware.
Safely remove hardware. You don't have to do that anymore. Did it get somehow better? No. What happened is that the way a journaled file system works, it doesn't write to the disk all at once or right away when you write data. It will wait and then commit in a batch. And it's a more reliable way of doing it. You're much less likely to get the operating system or the files damaged by a sudden disconnect. However,
right.
however, it's still doing delayed writing, so it is possible to disconnect before writing is finished. Now, in most cases, your files will be fine, your system will be okay. It's not going to, like in the old days, spew data all across your drive. That's not going to be the problem. However,
right.
Whatever you were doing may not be completed. So it is probably a good idea, even on Windows, even though it doesn't make you, to safe still write. And by the way, notice that command is still there. You can still do it to
right.
safely disconnect hardware. They don't make you do it. Now, it's funny because I know Mac guys who say, oh, I just pull it out. And Mac, you know, the Mac will give you a big
I've
Mac,
done that before.
Mac will complain.
Devices.
He'll say, oh, how did you just, it's unsafe. Oh, Mac is a whiny little, you know, kind of, you know, it's overly concerned about security. On the other hand, Windows is a little bit, you know, hey, whatever, dude. You disconnected, no problem, okay?
Yeah, it's more liberal. You're
whatever.
Right.
Now, but the irony is it's exactly the same on both platforms, the same issues. It's not like one does it better than the other. It's just how the operating system manufacturers have decided to deal with it.
Well, let me ask one more question before I go.
And I just want to say, Lawrence, I've never yet had a problem. If you wait a few seconds after the operation is done, and I would do
okay.
that if you've got a thumb drive, you know, you have the blinking light. If the light's blinking, don't pull it out. Wait until the operation's done. It's fine to pull it out.
That's usually what I
yeah.
tend to do. The one last thing I was wanting to ask you about that, same thing, it ties in with it. If you're, like, updating constantly on that stuff, do you think that there will ever come a time where I can just do it for my car without having to take it in and attach it?
Already
I know
is. Already is. There's a number of cars. Microsoft showed this at CES. A car that would sync up, you pull into it uses Bluetooth or Wi-Fi.
Pull up in your garage.
And it syncs.
That's what I want.
Car says, here I am, give me the latest songs, and it'll sync. The technology is not complicated. It's there. It's just that somebody has to implement it, and Microsoft's showing it. I don't know if anybody's doing it yet, but a Bluetooth
yeah.
car could do it or a Wi-Fi car could do it.
See, that'd be amazing, because I think for just music in general, no big deal. But when you're doing podcasts and you're really getting involved and listening to like NPR, Twit, I listen to all the time, Cranky Geeks even. And, I mean, it's nice to be able to not have to take your
That's
iPod
cool.
out of the car every time.
How are you listening?
Because then I forget it.
How are you listening to the show? You listen on podcast?
I listen to all your shows on podcast. I mean, I listen to Dig, all of them. I'm a podcast junkie.
Because you know you can't get us. You can't get us in WFLA in Tampa.
I know. I even listen to Tech Guy. It's nicer to cater my radio station to my own desires. And sometimes I like movies. Sometimes I like music. And I love technology. So
you know, I think ultimately you know. For users, really what it's all about is I want to hear what I'm interested in when I want to hear it, wherever I am. And, you know, if you're listening to the show live because you're in the car at that time, that's great. And the nice thing about that is live, right? You know, you're listening at the same time as everybody else is. There's a community feeling. It's live. It's great. You got to do it if you're going to call in. But if it's not convenient, you can also listen another time. That's why TiVo is so successful. And, you know, it's great. The companies are finally realizing that's all consumers want. They just want the convenience of listening to what they want, where they want, when they want it. I've been using those lines in speeches for 5 years, and it's now finally getting there. And that's one of the reasons success of TiVo, one of the reasons for the success of podcasting. Matt, Los Angeles. Hello, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for taking the call.
What can I do for you?
Well, I have two quick questions and one sort of comment to throw out there.
All right.
Over the past couple episodes, especially with Vista coming out, a lot of people have been asking about non-destructive partitioners.
Yes, because people want basically what Partition Magic will do, but it doesn't support Vista yet.
Exactly. And I've actually, through a little bit of intuitive clicking here, I was able to find out that you can use the Windows Vista disk if you boot to it in safe mode.
Yeah.
It gives you an option to run the command prompt from Vista.
Okay.
And Vista, in its new command prompt in this part, has a built-in disk shrink feature that's non-destructive.
Excellent.
Now, if you have your chat window open, which I'm sure you do, I am just pasting it in now.
It's now, in this red. Is interactive. I see you. Yep.
And you know what's really also sort of weird is in the new Windows Vista TechNet, there is no reference numbers, just links.
Are you a TechNet member?
I'm not a member, but I go to it for all my help.
I think TechNet's great, and actually trying to get a membership from Microsoft because it's not cheap, but it's a really useful resource. Disk part command line options. You know, it makes sense that they built that in because one of the things that you can do with the Vista install is shrink your XP partition and add a new partition and put Vista in it, much like Linux installers have done for years. So it makes sense that they'd add that feature. There's also a non-destructive partitioner a lot of people like. It's Linux-based called gparted, G-P-A-R-T-E-D. And that's free. Of course, you have to boot to the Linux disk, and then it'll do it. But it will handle NTFS partitions, gparted. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate the call. Leo Laporte here. I am the tech guy. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy, taking your calls, talking about technology. Coming up in just a little bit, a very important segment from Steve Gibson, our security guy. The wireless update Microsoft won't tell you about, but that you will want to download. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. Steve Gibson, our regular security expert on the show. Let me go to line five. Fred's in San Mateo. Hello, Fred. Welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
Hey.
I enjoy your show.
Thank you so much for listening.
I have a question about 1080p compatibility.
Yep.
When you plug in a Blu-ray DVD set to 1080p output,
mm-hmm.
and you plug it into a 1080i native plasma or projector,
yep.
advertised to be 1080p compatible, what can you expect to see on the screen?
Very much the same thing as you would see if you had a 1080p display, in my opinion. Now, I've talked to a lot of reviewers, very high-end reviewers. Let me talk a little bit about what's going on here.
Okay.
There's I and there's P. Traditional, cheesy old broadcast television like we've watched for years is about 380 to 400 lines of interlaced resolution. That means that the odd lines are drawn first, then the even lines are drawn in two passes of an electron gun. That's because at the time when television was invented, they didn't think they had enough bandwidth, frankly, to draw the whole screen in one pass. It couldn't do it. So they split the screen up. So a broadcast signal is 60 fields a second or 30 frames a second. It passes through 60 times to give you a 30 frame per second resolution. It draws half the frame at a time. Flash forward now to higher resolutions. Better displays. Displays absolutely capable of drawing the whole screen at once. Your computer display, for instance, is progressive. It doesn't do half the thing and then the other half. That would give you a flickery display. It gives you a nice, solid, all-in-one pass. Now, we're no longer using CRT displays. I mean, the plasma's not a CRT and LCD's not a CRT. These are digital displays. So when you're talking about 1080p versus 1080i on digital displays, what you're really talking about is the native resolution of the TV. Many high-def televisions don't have more than 720 lines top to bottom. So when it gets to a 1080p signal, they can't display. They have to interpolate to make it, and they call it 1080i, to make it work on that 720p. You are starting to see LCD and plasma screens that have 1,080 lines or more from top to bottom. They don't have to do that interpolation. Here's the interesting thing. Does it look better? Now, you mentioned Blu-ray, and that's important because there aren't very many sources of 1080p content. If you're watching your high-def broadcast on your cable or over the air, you're not getting 1080p. The only time you see 1080p really is on these high-def DVDs, mostly on Blu-ray. Everybody I've talked to, every high-end reviewer I've talked to says, look, I've looked at 1080p content on both native 1080 resolution screens and 720 screens that have to interpolate, and I defy you to notice a difference. The only time you might see a difference occasionally on some content where there's some very high-resolution detail, when you're looking for it, you're comparing side-by-side, you can tell the difference. For the example one reviewer gave me, he said, in one movie, there's a brick wall. I think it was Batman Begins. There's a brick wall in the background. And if you look at the two pictures side by side, as you freeze frame them, there's more detail in the brick in the 1080p than there is in the eye. He said, but who's looking at the brick anyway? My point is I wouldn't spend a lot of extra money to get a 1080p display. You're not going to see a lot of content in 1080p. And even if you do, you're not going to see a lot of difference.
I'm trying to figure out the merits of 1080i compatible versus just 1080i. In other words, is there really a difference?
Nope.
So theoretically,
Here's the interesting thing. Now, Scott, we asked Scott Wilkinson about this last week, I think. And one point thing he pointed out is all of these displays are converting it to P anyway, 1080p internally. What really makes the biggest difference, and it's much more important than the native resolution of your screen. Again, this is my opinion. And people will call and tell you, no, that's not true. So you're asking my opinion. I'm giving you my opinion. The biggest difference is not the resolution of the display. It is the quality of those scaling chips, the software and the DSPs that are in those, how good a job they do. And that's very important because, first of all, you're not always watching high-res content. Sometimes you're watching low-res content. You want that to look good, too. And if you've got a good chip in there, it'll make even standard definition television look acceptable. If you've got a bad chip, you watch standard definition television on a high-res display on a HDTV, you're going to say, what's wrong with my picture?
Have you seen any projectors that are 1080i native with which are 1080p compatible?
All of them are. All of them will play 1080p.
All of them will.
All of them will. Absolutely.
Okay.
They won't give you the full 1,080 lines of resolution because they can't.
But you can leave your, let's say, your Blu-ray DVD, you can leave it
absolutely
set to 1080p out. You don't have to set it to 1080i.
I don't know of any that won't do that, but certainly you would look. I bought a Pioneer HD TV Plasma, 1080p, quote, compatible. All it means is it just scales it to fit the screen. It looks fantastic. I don't think you'd tell the difference. 1080i is fine. People spend a lot of money to get 1080p, and I think they're buying snake oil at this point. I don't think they're getting anything that looks that much better. Now, there are those, and, you know, there are people, remember when CDs came out, said, I can hear a difference. I don't like that CD. I want my vinyl back. There's still people who say that. I want a tube amplifier. So there are plenty of videophiles who will say, oh, no, Leo, you clearly don't have the vision to see the difference between 1080p and 1080i. Well, I'm not just basing it on my opinion, but the opinion of many experts. I would say the vast majority of experts don't think that makes any difference. Certainly not the $2,000 or $3,000 difference you'd have to pay. Coming up, the wireless update Microsoft won't tell you about, but you've got to have, with Steve Gibson. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. From the beautiful Tech Guy Labs, high atop Silicon Valley, looking down on the entire thing, the thingamabob, I'm Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, and with me, Steve Gibson. As every week, he joins us to talk about security. And, you know,
I got a call on this show about, must have been almost a year ago, 6 months ago, that stumped me about something called free public Wi-Fi. I thought I'd bring Steve in to talk a little bit about this subject, because it turns out to be kind of an important thing. The guy said, I was in an airport, and I opened my laptop, and I saw a network, free public Wi-Fi. I logged in thinking it was free public Wi-Fi, and I found nothing. I couldn't get online. And he said, was I hacked?
Yes, this is a really interesting issue that surfaced with Windows XP. They have something called Wireless Zero Configuration, which is designed to sort of make Windows XP hook up easily to whatever wireless network you're around. And for example, you join networks. For example, you've got Wi-Fi at home, and so you connect to it, and maybe you have Wi-Fi at work. Well, it creates a list of preferred networks so that when you are next in that area, Windows will see that there's a network there and connect to it. The problem is that some networks have what's called a beacon, a so-called SSID. Technically it stands for Service Set Identifier, which basically is the name of the network. Normally, networks have a beacon that sort of broadcasts that name out into the air around. So if computers are nearby, they'll receive the name, they check to see if it's on their list, and if so, they'll join that network.
You can also do it manually, too. You can scan for networks, you'll see a network, you can join it that way.
Right, but you can only scan for the networks that are broadcasting that name.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Some networks, because it's believed to be a little more secure, they won't broadcast their own SSID. So what Windows does instead is it sends out probes saying, am I near this network? Am I near this network? Am I near that network?
Oh, so it assumes sometimes that there's no broadcast ID and just sends out a query, tries to log onto the network.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
And what's creepy about this is anybody who's got another computer set up to so-called sniff the traffic, they're able to see the probes coming from your computer. And so it's really a privacy leakage in Windows XP, because basically your computer, when it's not connected to a network, is trying to connect to all the networks it knows about by sending out the name saying, hi, is this network around? How about this one?
So now, how does this have anything to do with the free public Wi-Fi?
Essentially what happened was, There are two types of networks. There's a so-called infrastructure network. That's the one that most people are used to, where you have a base station creating an infrastructure, and then one or more machines hook up to it. That's what, for example, everyone is using at home, is a so-called infrastructure network.
Right.
But it's also possible for two machines to connect directly to each other without using a base station. So rather than like relaying their traffic through a base station, and without one at all in the area, two Wi-Fi computers can connect together. That's called an ad hoc, A-D-H-O-C, an ad hoc network.
Sometimes it'll say computer-to-computer network or something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. Microsoft calls it a computer-to-computer network to make it right. a little more clear for people. So what happens is, because of the way XP was configured with this so-called wireless zero configuration, somebody somewhere once got this free public Wi-Fi on their laptop, and they probably were actually using free
public
Wi-Fi.
Maybe there really was one at some point somewhere.
Somewhere there right. was. Well, what happened was, then two guys in an airport terminal both had their computers on, and this computer that had the free public Wi-Fi said, "Hey, is there free public Wi-Fi around?" Well, it turns out that If the way these ad hoc networks work, other computers could join them after sort of seeing their broadcast and would connect to it automatically. In doing so, it added the free public Wi-Fi to its list of preferred networks, and now anytime it's disconnected, it's broadcasting it.
So you see this, basically it's spreading. It's not a virus, but it's spreading virally. In fact, I've seen it on an airplane where I know there's no internet. Just somebody's got his laptop open and it's sending
yep.
it.
It's a perfect example on an airplane where you have lots of commuters who are all using their laptops. They probably have left their Wi-Fi turned on. And so exactly as you said, it's hopping from one laptop to another, all over the place.
I want to thank
Dwight Silverman.
Dwight Silverman, who is writes the tech blog for the Houston Chronicle, because that's where I first saw this explanation. And he did a lot of research to come up with it. Now, there is good news. There's a fix for it. The bad news is, you probably never got it.
Yes, it's really annoying. For some reason, Microsoft fixed this back in mid-October of 06.
And a lot of other, very serious problems with Zero Wireless Config.
Yes, there was a so-called wireless client update for Windows XP, which it's not in the normal Windows update list. So even if you're a person who religiously makes sure that your computer has all the latest patches, unless you explicitly go and get the wireless client update, your system is still working in this arguably not very private and not very safe fashion.
It's not even in the optional updates. It's nowhere on Windows Update.
Is nowhere to be found. Oh, you need to go. People can put wireless client update into Google. And as you discovered, Leo, it's the first link that comes up, so people can get it that way, or they can go to your show notes in order to get a link to this. But the takeaway message for everyone hearing this is something they want to do because they want to shut down this promiscuity of their Wi-Fi connections of their laptops and even fixed station machines.
Yeah, it also fixes a lot of bugs. Man, we get calls. I've got calls for several. Well, since they push this wireless Zero Config out, which was right around Service Pack 2. I've been getting calls from people saying, oh, I'm losing my Wi-Fi network periodically, and frequently disabling that service fixes it. Well, this fixes it in a much more sensible way. You keep the service, but it's not doing the stupid things it was doing before. So
yeah, I don't understand why Microsoft didn't just automatically make this available to everyone. They really should have, but people are going to have to go get it.
Google wireless client update, or you go to thetechguylabs.com, and we will have a link in the show notes there. Steve Gibson's site is grc.com. That's where he sells his great disk recovery and maintenance software, SpinRite. I've used it for years. It is the best. There is nothing better. He also, though, offers a lot of free security utilities there. And that's where you can also hear our podcast that we do together every week, Security Now, part of the TWIT family of shows. So if you'd like to hear this kind of stuff and in greater detail, that's Security Now, and it's wonderful. It's either at twit.tv or grc.com. And Steve joins us every week to talk about security. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Leo.
You want to really make sure you do that update. It's funny because for so long I've get calls and tell people just disable that Zero Config, but now there's a fix. Thank goodness. Joyce, Apple Valley, California. Hello, Joyce. Welcome. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
I have AOL email, and when I forward a message, all images are removed.
Yes, that's not you. That's the receiving party. And that's for security. Depends on what software they're using, but most software now will disable images in email. Do they come in as attachments, Joyce, or do they just...
They usually come in as part of the email. They might be cutesy little things with pictures within the body of the message. And all my friends are getting mad because they don't bother to send email. We can't see what you're showing anyway.
Are they using Outlook, most of them, or...
I don't know what they most have either AOL or SBC.
Reason is those emails can be dangerous. And so nowadays, most email programs disable inline images. There will be, you just have to say, oh yeah, that's your software is quote protecting you from me. You can tell them what you need to do is change the settings in the software to enable inline images. That'll be in the options, and it's different for every program, but it'll be in the options of that program. Sometimes there'll be a button. Usually there'll be a button on the image that says, on the email that says load images, or there are images in this email. Do you want me to load them? And it will load the inline images. There are reasons that they turn these off, security reasons, and that's what's going on. A lot of times they'll still come in as attachments, although, again, sometimes email programs, because attachments often contain viruses, will even disable those. And that's also a setting in the options.
There's nothing I need to do.
It's not you.
Because I have AOL and I have Verizon for the server, and I have a .Mac account.
It's not you. It's not you. You're not doing it. Their software's doing it on their end.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you just tell them they have to change their settings. Now, let me explain why it does it. A couple of problems. One is that for a long time in Windows, still is the case if you haven't patched Windows, even a seemingly innocent JPEG image could carry a virus. This is because of flaw in one of Microsoft's programming libraries allowed malformed JPEG images. They looked like pictures, but they to contain a virus. That was one problem. There's one, and this is more common, more of an issue, is that spammers often put zero-sized images, 1 pixel by 1 pixel, invisible images in their email, and use that as a way of seeing if you're reading it, seeing if you're a real address. So let's say I send you an email and I put an invisible image in there. Now, those images are not coming they're not in the email. They're coming from a server. So when that image is displayed, even though it's invisible, it tells the server, it goes to the server and says, hey, I'm loading this image now. So the spammer keeps track of that, keeps track of who it's sending emails to. And it says, oh, yeah, okay, this is a good address, because that's what they want. They don't want addresses that aren't real. So, well, that's a good address. So it gives the spammer some information. In fact, for a while, there was a service. I don't know if they're still around, but there was a service that did this to all your emails so you could see if people were actually reading your email. It would even tell you how long they had the email open, things like that. So these are security problems. Many programs now will also disable attachments. Now, I think in your case, your email is not coming loaded from it's not loading from the server. It's coming as an attachment. I'm pretty sure that's how AOL does images. It adds them as attachments. Now, the email software can display them what we call inline. That's very convenient. You don't have to open an attachment. You just see it. But that's disabled nowadays, inline attachments. So your friends may tell your friends either enable inline attachments or have it load inline attachments or disable the security feature. But I don't recommend that because attachments are so dangerous, really. Leo Laporte here. I am the Tech Guy. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, welcoming our new listeners in West Palm Beach, Florida. Great to have you on WFTL. And, of course, all over the country on XM Satellite, Channel 152. And everywhere there are geeks, this show will be. That's our goal. You know, one thing I thought of, and I should have asked our last caller, you know, I presumed that she was using a recent version of AOL. If you were using... In fact, I know she was because she said it used to work. In versions prior to, I think it was version 6 of America Online Software, they actually stripped out the images and zipped them. And so they were zip files, unless she went back to an older version of AOL. But if you're using 7, 8, or 9, any of the recent versions of AOL, they should show up in the message. It's your recipients that aren't seeing the images. Show notes are online. TechGuyLabs.com is the place to go. TechGuyLabs.com. My email is leo@techguylabs.com. And those show notes get updated throughout the week because people send me email, they send me corrections, suggestions. I don't pretend to know every answer by any means. I do my best, and if I don't know, I'll say I don't know. But often, by the end of the week, we've got, you know, really a very good, thorough discussion of the problem on the show notes. Techguylabs.com. Thanks to Shuby for keeping those show notes during the show. Thanks, too, to my chat moderators, Dan and Dustin, Illuminati and Mike B., Red Sox Dan and Shuby. They're all keeping the chat room safe and sane for everybody of any age. Mike B. maintains a list of places you can hear the stream on the internet at techguy.starthan.com. They do a great job. I really appreciate their support. Of course, thanks to Jeff Cabot on the phones today and the wonderful Antonia Giordano on the board for making me sound so good. Jonathan from somewhere in the southern part of California. Welcome, Leo Laporte.
Right. Hi, Leo. My daughter has a Philips MP3 player, and she's now purchased a MacBook Pro. What she wants to do is move her directory of all of her music from that Philips, which, over to the MacBook. The problem is the Philips only works with Media Player, and she had Media Player 11, which is the most recent version, on her Windows PC, but they do not support that on the Apple. It's only version 9, which doesn't really have a directory. So is there a way she can convert it back to the iTunes?
Yeah, what you're running into, now, did she buy these songs online, or did she just make them herself?
She's done both. She's bought a lot from iTunes, and she's made copies, you know, of her
anything
CDs
that she
so
bought,
she could play.
But she didn't buy stuff in a Windows-based music store.
No. It's okay. All iTunes.
Okay. So these WMA files that she's having trouble with, and you're right. iTunes will import some WMA format files, but not all. If it cannot import them, probably the best thing to do is to burn them to an audio CD. Make a CD out of them. And so this will back them up anyway. She can actually burn the albums as if she's making CDs and then import them through iTunes.
Will it convert it back to that iTunes format?
Yeah. What I would recommend in future, just to give you the most flexibility, is to not use the iTunes format, the AAC format, but to use MP3. And iTunes will do that if you do it in the settings, in the import settings.
Uh-huh.
And the reason being, MP3 works everywhere for everything. And
will she be able to get her directory over from the Philips back on to the Mac?
Not the directory. She'll have to burn those albums and import them on the Mac. So one by one, she'll have to burn the CDs. It could be painstaking. The advantage of doing this, by the way, she'll have a backup of all her CDs, which is not a bad thing.
I see. Should she use that,
the Roxio or the Nero, whatever burning software
that Yahoo thing, that
Music Match. Yeah, that'll work.
You.
Yeah, burn an audio CD with Music Match. Anything that can burn those songs to a CD should work fine. There's, you know, by the way, I should mention there might be a slight degradation. What you're doing is you're decompressing these files and then recompressing them. If you compress them to a high enough quality MP3, I'd recommend 160 kilobits or 192 kilobit MP3. It'll sound fine. And teenagers anyway don't care that much these days, frankly.
Okay. Thank
and that
you.
Way she'll it's the trick is from in future avoid copy protection. Those things just make it harder on you. Now and they may I was not aware of the fact that iTunes wouldn't import Media Player 11 files. That surprises me. I know it'll import Media Player files. I guess they either changed the format. She may have checked the box that says protect these songs. That could have done it too. If it's copy protected anyway, even if she did it, iTunes won't import it. So if you've got copy protected material, the best thing to do, burn it to an audio CD and then import the audio CD and import it in an unprotected format. I recommend MP3 at 160 kilobits. It'll sound great and you'll never have to worry about this again. Then you just move it around any machine, any player. You know, the iPod's not going to be king of the world forever. Something new will come along. And at that point, you won't have to worry about it. Just move right over because for sure everything will support MP3. That's for sure. David Riverside, I think you're gonna be the last call today. Hey, David, welcome. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. The problem I'm having is I'm running Windows XP on my desktop computer,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be working on a file or working in a program, and all of a sudden the pointer on my mouse goes haywire and starts jumping all over the screen, opening up files everywhere. Usually starts with like the start button, and it'll just start opening files.
That
everywhere.
Is annoying. And now, that was happening in my mom's machine on Windows 2000. First thing I do is see if you have another mouse, check and plug it in and see if it works okay.
Okay.
It could just be a bad mouse.
A bad mouse?
In fact, it most likely is.
Okay.
If you plug in a different mouse, and by the way, you get a mice for $5. I mean, you don't have to get a fancy.
Well, right, yeah, they're not expensive.
If it does it on another mouse, I'd borrow a friend's just to make sure. And by the way, try a USB mouse instead of a PS2 mouse. But if it does it on another mouse, then there could be a driver issue. And I would make sure you get the latest mouse drivers. Frankly, Microsoft's IntelliMouse drivers work with all mice, and they're very good drivers, and that's what I would do. If it's still happening, you've got a new mouse, you've got updated drivers, and it's still happening, then it's something more serious. It could be, in fact, the connector on your motherboard. That's why I suggest you use USB. Chances are it's not going to happen with the USB connector. And in some minor situations, it could be actually spyware or a hacker messing with you. I don't want to say that because I don't think it's what it is, and I wouldn't worry about it. But I should, for completeness, mention that. I'm out of time, but I'll be back next week on this same bat station at the same bat time. Will you join me? I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great week.
You love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy on KFI is provided by DSL Extreme at dslextreme.com.